When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Driving plays a big part in driving the local economy. It helps us all get where we're going and creates good jobs close to home. At Cenovus Energy, our refineries in Toledo and Lima are a reliable domestic source of gasoline, diesel, and jet fuel. Plus, more than 2,300 employees and contractors work for us here in Ohio. See how we're helping local communities move forward at cenovus.com.
Welcome everyone to So Very Wrong About Games, a board gaming podcast about board games. I am your co-host, Mark Bigney. An update, Michael Walker is still recovering from a stroke, and it is with that I can introduce our newest entrant to the elite group that I'm starting to call the Swag Auxilia. And this is someone who needs no introduction, but I assuredly have never let superfluity get in the way of more words, so I will say that in addition to producing some of the very best content in our hobby, he is someone of extraordinary generosity and has been of invaluable help to me personally, and above all that, he is someone I feel privileged to call friend. Welcome to Swag, Efka Bladukas, of no pun included.
I resent all of these accusations, and you shall be hearing from my lawyers.
You deny the allegations and defy the alligator?
Indeed, I do defy the alligator.
Are you willing to commit that your name is indeed Efka Bladukas?
Yes, if I have to.
I have extracted a reluctant concession, and with that, we will call that a compromise and move forward. So, we're going to talk about board games this week. We're going to talk about the games we played this week. We're going to talk about the news and why it doesn't matter. We're going to talk about our feature game, which is Slay the Spire, the board game. And then I'm going to let Efka go back to producing better content. So, with that in mind, let us begin with the games we played last week. Efka, what have you been playing?
I have been playing Captain Flip because, as you know, the Spiel des Jahres nominations have happened. And out of the six games on the Spiel and Kenner Spiel nominations, I have played only four of them. So I was like, quickly, let's catch up. So Captain Flip has been designed by Remo Consadori and also Paolo Mori. Now, I know that on the So Very Wrong About Games podcast, people are fans of Paolo Mori, and I'm also a fan of Paolo Mori, so I was excited to play this game by Paolo Mori. It's all right. I liked it. It's nice. It is incredibly light because the game can be summed up in one sentence. You draw a tile out of the bag, then you look at the tile. If you like the tile, you will place it on your tableau. If you don't like the tile, you flip it, and then you are forced to place it on your tableau. That's it. That's the game, right? That's pretty much succinctly described, but also it is what it is, right? It's just this sort of sensation of like, this isn't good. This didn't come out at the right time because this tile actually is going to lose me points rather than score me points because, you know, tiles interact with other tiles and then there's adjacency or height, you know, how far they are up on your ship, because your board is a ship, right? Because you are Captain Flip. And then you go like, I don't know if I want this. So you take a chance and flip it, and it could be amazing or it could be terrible. And if that sounds like fun to you, Captain Flip will be a good time. And if that sounds like hell to you, it will be hell.
Normally, we shy away from giving full rules explanations of games here on So Very Wrong About Games, but I think that in some cases, exceptions need to be made, and I think Captain Flip is absolutely one of those exceptions. It is so minimalistic in its rule set. There are two things I have to comment. I'm going to need to play Captain Flip a little bit more to try to see how much there is there. I'm really not sure. I'm in a state of uncertainty. I've played it about a half a dozen times on Board Game Arena, never in person, and I feel a little bit at sea, as it were. That is what we call in the industry a bit of a pun. I know you don't engage in those, Efka, so I wanted to introduce you to that style of wordplay.
Never once in my life.
One thing I will observe is that although I am a big fan of Palomori's games, especially Dogs of War and Blitzkrieg, those are probably my two favorite Palomori designs, this reminds me a little bit of Libertalia in that I feel it is at the opposite end of a spectrum, because the effects of the Libertalia cards create more chaos than I can process. And that's part of the design. That's very much the design intent, I think, in Libertalia. In Captain Flip, some of the tiles gesture towards what I think could be a more interesting game. And I kind of want Captain Flip to play a little bit more with those possibilities, but it doesn't. I think also because that's the kind of game that it's trying to be. I will give one example. So there's the Cannoneer. The Cannoneer gives you 5 points when you place her. And if you have 3 Cannoneers by the end of the game, you flatly lose. And this has created, so far, the only moments of tension I've ever felt when playing Captain Flip, because when early in the game you get that first Cannoneer, you already feel like you're on a path to ruin. But the prospect of those instant 5 points is so tempting. And then you start thinking, well, maybe if I get that monkey that flips adjacent tiles, I could then bury the Cannoneer if I need to, and or activate the Cannoneer a second time and still not incur any more risk. These moments, unfortunately, are few and far between in Captain Flip, and much of the time I find the tile effects to be like, oh, well, this one doesn't really do much for me, I'll flip it over. Oh, this one doesn't really do much even. Anyway, okay, I'll stick it somewhere, and that's that. And so despite the fact that it's very quick, I feel like there's a lot of nothing that transpires, or very, very small stakes. And I feel like it's close to something that, without more rules overhead, I think could be a more tense, engaging, fulfilling experience.
I wonder if this is going to be a subject of some sort of a Uwe Rosenberging of the system, because what Uwe often does is like he has a core design idea and then he iterates and iterates and iterates with multiple releases. And I think you can sort of see that from Palomori too, with, yes, Dogs of War and Blitzkrieg, but also like, you know, then taking a similar design approach and doing something like Caesar. This could happen. This could be a more complicated game if it wanted to or needed it to be. But I feel like looking for that experience is kind of foregoing the basic core experience, which is just having fun flipping tiles, you know? And I wonder if it was always meant to just be that, with a little bit of a, you know, sprinkling of that sort of gaminess where you get to make some decisions. With the Cannoneer, like I took the completely opposite approach than you did. What I did was basically whenever I saw the Cannoneer, I just flipped the Cannoneer over and was like, I hope that it comes in the end game so that like I don't have to stress about it for the entire game. But like at the end of the game, I might get lucky and pull the Cannoneer and be like, hey.
I hear what you're saying. And it is entirely within the realm of possibility that, as I said, I'm wanting Captain Flip to be something that it could never be, or certainly was not intended to be. But I actually thought the other observation I had was in the context of a recent social media post by Eric Lang. And one of the things that he observed, and I think this is absolutely true, is that Eurogamers especially, but hobbyist gamers more broadly, tend to overfocus on how simple your turn is as a sort of stand-in for approachability of rule sets, and then completely ignore all the stuff on the back end about things like convoluted scoring or combinatoric elements. And I was thinking about that in terms of Captain Flip, because Captain Flip has a whole bunch of different tile effects, and they're all simple, but just because the actual atomistic turns are so straightforward doesn't completely elide the fact that there is some math going on, and there are some combinations going on, and there are some spatial considerations that are precisely more complicated in a way that are daunting to non-gamers. And I've just had some recent experience with non-hobbyist gamers recently, again, reminding me that what I may think is simple and approachable isn't. And so I wonder, basically what I'm saying is that if you wanted to play around with the different tile effects, I wonder how much you would be losing in terms of approachability if you did that. I think it's an open question.
I agree.
So that is Captain Flip. More to follow from me anyway. I'll be playing more Captain Flip over the course of the week. What are the other games dominated for the SDJ and the Kennerspiel that you need to try?
Well, I have tried now already in the footsteps of Darwin, which kind of escaped my notice. But I have since played it and I regret playing it. So it was designed by Gregory Grad and Matthew Verdier. I'm sorry. So this is published by Sorry We Are French. I am sorry. I am not French. and out of the two, no pun included, members, my French is non-existent, whereas Elaine's is pretty good. So
I will provide all the representation of the Francophonie that you will need.
Thank you very much. Sorry We Are French has published a game, and I'm sorry I have played it. I just didn't like anything about this. So much like Captain Flip, this is a tile tableau building game. What you have is basically a grid of 3x3 that is constantly refilled by tile options. And you have this boat that sails around this grid. And the way it sails is that when your turn starts wherever the boat is, you look at the column or row that the boat is pointing at, and then you pick up the tile, and then if the tile was one space away, you move the boat once, and if the tile was two spaces away, you move it twice. You basically collect tiles, right? And these tiles will combine in various ways to score you more points, and definitely in more gamey and more complicated ways than Captain Flip. There's, you know, tiles have various attributes, like what region of the world the animal is from, because you're collecting like information about animals, and then also what type of animal it is. So you could have like lizards or like insects from Africa or birds from Africa, but you could have insects or mammals from Australia. So you collect these, plus there's various characters from the Darwin CU, I guess, cinematic universe, right? So they appear as well, and you can collect them, and they'll provide you with various bonuses. And there's various scoring opportunities, like you can collect compasses, and then each parchment you collect, you will multiply that by the number of compasses you've collected, and that's how many points you get at the end of the game. And there's additionally various bonuses that you get, and the most important one, and the one that made me regret playing this game, is like getting a full set from a continent. Right. So if you have like one mammal, or you can have more than one, you know, one bird, one insect, one lizard from, say, Australia, right, you get like a 5-point bonus. Now, where this gets weird is the player count, because In the Footsteps of Darwin goes from 2 to 5. And with 5, it is pure chaos because you can't plan anything. By the time it gets back to your turn, like there's only 9 tiles. The whole thing will have completely changed, right? Right. Now, in a 2-player game, it's super tight. There's this whole metagame about like, oh, if I move the boat 2 spaces, you know, I get this tile, but then, you know, my opponent will be forced to move like in a way that they won't be able to get the tile they want, and I'll can get the tile. Like, there's a whole mind game going on, which is nice. I don't mind that, right? I like that. But the problem is that you don't chuck the full set of tiles. You just randomly take like a chunk of tiles and stick them in a bag. And it might be possible, for example, that there is no Australian bird in the whole bag of tiles.
Nice.
But there's no way of knowing that.
Right.
So I was like, no, I'm done. Thank you. That's just no, thank you.
Set collection is very easy to mess up. And it is precisely in those kinds of situations that I feel like this was perhaps used as just a standard overdone kind of scoring mechanism. You have to ensure that the set is going to show up, or at least the math works out right. Otherwise, it's this absurd gamble to try to go down this path. That sounds very frustrating.
It was frustrating. It's just, like, it's not a bad game. There's a nice amount of tension there. Like, I regret playing this. I regret playing this because I didn't get out of it what I wanted to get out of it. I can see why it was nominated. There was like, a good amount of tension for a small amount of rules. Because, you know, it's like, you take a tile, you move a ship, there's consequences. That's nice, right? I like that. But I don't know. It just feels like something was missing. That like there isn't this sort of ideal player count number where like it's either too chaotic or too inconsistent. Like there's no right number, it feels.
Well, moving on to more French things, I got to play It's a Wonderful World with the Corruption and Ascension expansion. This was designed by Frédéric Guérard and published by La Boîte de Jeux. And on the topic of accessible games, I absolutely tend to gravitate towards It's a Wonderful World, because with the expansion, it goes up to 6 or 7 players. And one of the comments that one gets when playing It's a Wonderful World, which is a drafting game, it's a relatively pure drafting game with elements of light economic planning, and reliably, I get the comment that I got this time, which is, now I don't have to play Seven Wonders again, which I find very gratifying, because I too am an enthusiast of Antoine Boza, but not of Seven Wonders. And the thing that I really like about It's a Wonderful World, aside from its kind of ridiculously humorous dystopian theme, is just that element of light economic planning, because it's a very tight economy. You start off with very, very little production, and when you produce, what matters. And so you end up drafting cards, and you can do one of two things with cards. You can either sock them away to be built later, or just junk them to get a single cube, which tends to be roughly, at best, a third of what can produce a building. And so you're constantly left with this temptation to do too much. You look at these buildings and you go, oh, it'd be great if I could build all these buildings. Well, guess what? You can't. And so you do get those enjoyable trade-offs, I find. It's a very, very approachable hobbyist game. And because it can accommodate so many player counts, I find that hardcore hobbyists tend to enjoy it, and they also tend to appreciate it precisely as the kind of game that they can whip out in a variety of different contexts. It's not something that I would say is family weight, but it's getting darn near close. And at the very least, you tend to get a couple of chuckles out of some of the weird cards, like finding Blackbeard's gold or some sort of weird glitzy cathedral to capitalism with the giant diamond-encrusted gold dollar sign over an altar. And I figure if you can have a sense of humor about things, you might as well. And this has been in perennial rotation ever since we discovered it. And anytime I know that there's going to be 6 or 7 people and I have no idea what facility or what kind of weight of games they want to play, I tend to include It's a Wonderful World in rotation. And sure enough, it once again found new devotees. Have you played It's a Wonderful World?
I haven't even played Seven Wonders. embarrassing, I know. I don't know. 7 is such a difficult count, right? And there's so very few games that accommodate 7 well. But there's always Sidereal Confluence. That's what I say.
Play Sidereal Confluence.
You can always play. I'm sorry. I shoehorned that game in everywhere.
I will take issue with one characterization. The statement, you can always play Sidereal Confluence, I would change to, you should always play Sidereal Confluence, but sometimes you can't.
Because no, you cannot.
It is not a very approachable rule system, and people get overwhelmed with information very, very quickly. But yes, I agree. With 7, Sidereal Confluence is fabulous if people are able to handle the rules load and the information load.
And the table load.
Yes, absolutely. It's a bit of a hard recommendation for something like It's a Wonderful World, because it gets to 6 or 7 only with an expansion. And at that point, the economic prospect gets a little bit more difficult to justify. But it's my preferred pure drafting game of that ilk since Fairy Tail. And since Fairy Tail is a while back, that's saying something. And it's so flexible. As somebody who is the primary game provider of a variety of groups, it is a good thing to have in my arsenal.
I need to try this. I do like drafting games, so I don't know why I haven't yet. I really need to. I hear the sequel isn't as good.
I strongly dislike It's a Wonderful Kingdom, which is the two-player sequel. It is it changes a number of things mechanically, and I don't find it nearly as enjoyable. With two players, I would infinitely rather play It's a Wonderful World two players, frankly.
Okay. Talking of two players, I have played Cascadero at two players. And once again, I regret playing Cascadero at two players. It's just very clearly not a good two-player game. And I just assumed that it would be, because it is by Dr. Rainer Knizia, right? And Dr. Rainer Knizia usually, not always, but usually does games that work pretty well at two. I'm thinking of Through the Desert or Tigris and Euphrates or even like My City.
Tigris and Euphrates is a bit of a controversial take. There are a number of purists who say that it is not good with two. I am not one of them, but that is a bit divisive.
I guess it is, but you know, I found it to be good at two, and I found Yellow and Yangtze to be good at two. Quest for El Dorado, pretty good at
absolutely
two, right? Like so many of his games. The auction games, okay, right? I can see that. But Cascadero was definitely more along the lines of his, you know, tile layers or
right,
root drawers, as I call them, like Babylonia, which intersects with both of them, I think. Anywho, so Cascadero, you place little horsemen on the board to connect various cities. If you are the first to connect to a city, you'll get 1 point. But if you're like the second, you get more points, and so on and on and on, right? And so there's this whole cat and mouse game that's like, I want the person that's the other person on the table to go to the city that I want to go to, but before I do, and how do I get them to go there? Which sounds good, but actually, like, at two players, the board doesn't adjust at all. It's just too big, and there's too much room, and it becomes kind of wishy-washy and unpredictable. And I feel like with more players, it would open up and bloom. However, again, I haven't played it with more, but from what I've heard, you know, it's still not quite there, like, as his other more famous games, you know. And I've just recently tried Through the Desert for the first time, and I'm like, why would I not just play Through the Desert and get a very similar experience? Very similar, but better, and also consistently good at two.
Yes. It's a bit of a challenge, right? When you're, as you say, Dr. Reiner Knizia, and in the last 5 years of the 20th century, you designed arguably some of the greatest hobby games ever to have been designed. Certainly some of the greatest tiling games ever to be designed. You're almost never going to be able to escape your own shadow. And I agree. If something feels a little bit like Through the Desert, it's going to be hard not to suffer in comparison. And I think that Cascadero absolutely does. And a couple of things that Through the Desert does to accommodate lower player counts, which is something that a lot of tile layers do, Cascadero doesn't do. As you say, the board doesn't change. And as well, Cascadero is driven an awful lot in terms of the tempo and in terms of the scoring by these achievements. And the achievements are mostly about route connection. And if there are fewer people on the board and the routes are just wide open, there's a lot less difficulty, tension, and interest in getting to those achievements in the first place. And so I agree. Two-player Cascadero is not very good, and it is somewhat surprising that Knizia would let it suffer so in the player scaling.
I guess I don't know how they would have changed, because the packaging is quite small. It's not a big box, you know? So it's like, but maybe they could have printed an alternative map or something like that on the other side of the board. I don't know. But yeah, it was just, it just felt like a letdown, but also like even if it wasn't a letdown, it wasn't quite, it didn't feel as strong as his other titles, so.
Yeah, it's a bit of a shame. On the topic of two-player auction games, though, Raw with two players is shockingly good.
I am not a fan. I just didn't dig it. I know there are advocates for two-player Raw, but it felt, there was a looseness to it that I didn't appreciate. I don't know.
Sure. Have you played Blue Moon?
I have not. I've heard many good things about Blue Moon, and it's impossible to find a copy now without,
it's true,
you know, forking out, so. Just going to have to wait for someone to, for the license to expire or whatever it is that needs to happen.
There have been rumblings for a few years about possibly a reprint, but it's tough to tell. So I get to play Dungeons & Dragons, Dungeon Scrawlers, Heroes of Waterdeep again. I am a ridiculous booster of Dungeon Scrawlers, but I think I'm coming gradually, belatedly, Efka, to a realization. And that is that my enthusiasm for especially Heroes of Waterdeep, the second set of the series, the first one was Heroes of Undermountain, may be greater than most people's enthusiasm for the system. Because some people bounce off of Dungeon Scrawlers hard for all kinds of different reasons. Some of them I knew going in. So it's a real-time competitive sort of connect-the-dots game. And so some people don't want to do real-time games. That's fine. Set them aside. Some people don't really want to engage in what is kind of sort of a dexterity challenge because it's a real-time tracing game. That I understand as well. Set them aside. But then there are the people, and this I find somewhat common amongst hobby gamers, just as a gross personality generalization. They really like precision, and when it comes time to score Dungeon Scrawlers, they start panicking, and they start revolting against the game system. Because, for example, in Dungeon Scrawlers, the way you pick up treasure is you trace around a pile of treasure or a treasure chest, and the scoring criterion is if you can't see any of the yellow outline of the treasure, you score a point. And if you can see some of the yellow, then it doesn't score. I've had a number of experiences showing people Dungeon Scrawlers for the first time where they hear this scoring condition and they immediately start, their hackles raise, their back gets up, and they're immediately like, what are you talking about? That's so arbitrary and subjective. And I said, well, you either see some yellow or you don't. And yes, by a literal definition of subjective, that's subjective, but that's the criterion. And then they start saying things that start going down a discussion that I've heard many, many people, many times about people who want to assert that anything with judging isn't really a sport. And let me tell you how little enthusiasm I have for that discussion. And there's this weird false dichotomy that quickly gets erected between that which is pure and objective and that which is subjective and garbage. And it's like, I as a philosopher and as a number of other things, I have so many problems with this this architecture that you're trying to build. And by the way, can we play our fun Dungeon Scrawler game now? And they just, but it's too late. The buy-in is gone. They just can't deal.
Oh, no.
And they find the whole thing frustrating. Now, admittedly, to be entirely fair, the scoring of Dungeon Scrawlers is sometimes more time-consuming than the actual playing of the game. It's one of those kinds of things. The same is true of Lightspeed, but very much like Lightspeed, I find the novelty and the sheer fun and the delight of just going through to be more than worth it. But I'm encountering more and more people who don't want to feel it. And the Heroes of Waterdeep version has longer runs. Longer, more in-depth stuff. There are mini dungeons and other stuff going on. It's by no means complicated, but if you don't have the buy-in for this kind of goofy, novel, vaguely iconoclastic thing, you definitely want the simpler, shorter version so you can get it over with quickly and or so you don't overwhelm them.
This reminds me of the sort of general kind of meh from audiences when it came to Treasure Island by Matago. Yeah, that also had that sort of vagueness because you're just basically drawing with markers and rulers and also a compass as well,
yep.
Which is, you know, pretty unusual for board games. And there was definitely vagueness about like, well, like I drew these lines, does this count, does that? I don't know. I found that okay. What I think is very good and very important in games like that, that have this sort of vague scoring, is to have it be vague but also very... Like, if it's vague, then just commit fully to it. Have you ever heard of a game called Madrino?
No.
So Madrino is a roll and write game where you are designing plans for, like, someone's house.
Mm-hmm.
And you're all, like, in the same architectural agency or whatever. You're all drawing plans for the same client, right? And the nature of the game is that it's ridiculous because, like, there's, like, a 1 in 6 chance for a straight wall to come up. Everything else is like windows and corners and like there's like, you know, doors don't come up often enough. So you have these like really ridiculous blueprints that everyone ends up drawing. And the winning condition for the game is that basically when everyone is finished drawing their blueprint with the bathroom in the garden or whatever you end up doing, you all decide whose is the best and that person wins. And that's it. There are no other rules.
Yeah, that is absolutely the kind of thing that my core group with Walker and Huey, Dewey, and Louie would have no problem with, I think. But I could easily see lots of other groups having a serious problem with. It reminds me a little bit of our fake victory condition for Hyperborea. Hyperborea is kind of a light 4X-y bag-building thing, and we really love the gameplay. And somebody has the most points and they win. But the real winner is the one who has the best menagerie of animals on their civilization cards. Because for whatever reason, the artist went hog wild, and all the animals are like weird dinosaurs and flying lizards and manta rays and all manner of weird stuff. So it's like, yeah, sure, you get the most points, but do you have the awesome rhinos with 5 horns? Like, no, I don't. It's like, well, you don't win then.
That should be a rule in more games, really.
I agree. Which actually brings me to a game that we played together, which has an awesome tiebreaker condition. We played Power Vacuum, which is a trick-taking game about authoritarian anthropomorphic appliances. And I would have thought, after playing Bargain Hunter by Uwe Rosenberg, which is one of my favorite trick-taking games, that was going to be the only trick-taking game with anthropomorphic appliances that I was ever going to play. But Power Vacuum said, hold my beer, comrade, and has really decided to lean into this theme. So I don't know if this is just going to be a trend, maybe separated by 25 years each time. I don't know. But the conceit of Power Vacuum is that some loser's going to win the trick, and that's fine. Maybe they'll score a point from that. Maybe they'll decide to cash a card for next round as a consequence of that. But who cares? Because the real action goes to whoever played the lowest card of the trick. They get to mess with the power board. And the power board is just this bizarre combination of short-term points, but also a secret goal that people are trying to obtain. Because there are these nominal factions, The factions correspond to player colors in a very strange, somewhat attenuated way. And everyone's got this goal card at the top of the round. And the goal card might be, I want red to have the highest power and white to have the lowest power. Red and white may or may not be in the game. Who knows? They may be players, they may not be. Red might be Efka or red might be nobody. But the point is, that's your goal for the round. And whoever plays the lowest card every round gets to transfer power between two factions that are start out random, and then after they transfer the power, they then change which two factions are linked. So for example, say red and yellow are linked, I play the lowest card in a trick. I can transfer power from yellow to red or red to yellow, and then I could say, I don't want yellow and red to be transferring power between each other. I want yellow to now be transferring power with white, or with the supply, or what have you. And it's this dynamic, the transfer of power back and forth, that personally I found vastly more consequential and interesting than actually winning tricks. What was your impression of that?
Pretty much the same as yours. Like, I felt like at the beginning of the game, I looked at my hand and I was like, oh, I have some, you know, sevens, I have a couple of nines. That's nice. I can win some tricks, right? Right. And by the end of the game, it's like, I can't believe I keep winning tricks. No. right? Like,
the big light bulb moment for me, and I'm sorry, I shouldn't say light bulb, that may be triggering to the anthropomorphic appliances, was when somebody won a trick with one trump, and I realized, oh wait, that could be the strongest card in the game, because you're likely to win the trick, or at least more likely than any other one, and you're guaranteed to be playing the lowest. And the way that dynamic shifted, I was very impressed with the number balancing. Right, because you might think, oh, everyone's messing with the power board. It might get too chaotic. We played a game with three players and a game with four players. And in both cases, I really felt like I had just the right amount of control over who was going to be ending with a lot of power and who was going to be ending with a small amount of power.
My only like kind of moment with three players was that the trick taking itself felt a little bit too more rote than in a four player game. It was a four-player game. It had that tension of like, I just don't know what the right call is here. Whereas in a three-player game, it was like, well, obviously I play this card, right? So that was the only difference. But yes, that ability to manipulate it, but not being allowed to manipulate it too much, and you know, you don't quite know how the round is going to play out. That's pretty endemic to trick takers, where you don't see the whole thing until it happens, right? But weirdly here, it's not on the winning of the tricks, it's or of the cards that you play, but it's more to do with that power transfer system and how much you're going to bid towards, you know, which faction is going to win or lose or whatever.
And the way that over the course of a given hand, the opportunities for collusion really start to emerge, because the sooner you reveal your secret agenda, the more points you're apt to score. But you're also tipping your hand, quite literally. And I'm looking at my agenda and say, well, I could either want red to do well or white to do well. Oh, but white's already in the game, and white's a player, and so they're probably going to be trying to get some power into their corner anyway, because it's points for them. And I happen to notice that Efka has already declared that he wants red to be in the crapper this round. Okay, so you can play it later and get the fewer points, but a greater degree of assuredness. That collusive aspect I also enjoyed. But to circle back to what you were saying, overall, the power manipulation was cool. Deciding when and how to reveal your agenda was cool. I found the card play overall, both in terms of the trick-taking and the anti-trick-taking of playing the lowest card, to be pretty uninspired. And I felt that it was the weakest aspect of Power Vacuum, which is a bit of a shame, because nominally it's the way that you're interacting with these systems.
I agree. I didn't feel like that was particularly strong, but I think it falls in the remit of these trick-takers where they're not quite as crunchy as some others, but more just kind of laid back and like silly, watch silly things happen. Like, I'm thinking of Schadenfreude, which is definitely an example of those trick takers where like you don't quite see how this is playing out, but then things happen and they become very silly and kind of unpredictable and, you know, off-piste almost. And it's just fun. I don't know. Like, it's a breezy time. I have a trick taking ranking scale. I don't know if you know this, but This is a solid A. If it's not quite verging on S, but there's four ranks. So S is go get it. This is a great game for everyone, regardless of whether you like trick takers or not. A is like, this is pretty good, and it might transition to broader audiences, but mostly for trick taking aficionados. Then you have B, which is just for trick taking aficionados. This is a weird thing that like someone was experimenting and they, you know, because the costs of printing a trick-taking game are much lower, you know, they managed to make it happen and it's out there. It's a weird idea and someone's going to appreciate it. And then there's, you know, C, which is just stay away. Don't. There's no need. This is between A and S, you know, at the top, but not quite top.
I mentioned it as a joke, but I actually think that Bargain Hunter is one of my favorite trick-taking games. I wonder if you've tried it.
I've never tried it, but I am on BGG right now looking it up. I'm not joking.
This is one of Uwe Rosenberg's pre-Agricola card games. And it's got this fascinating system whereby at the top of the round, you declare what number will score you points. And anytime you capture a trick with those numbers, they go into your score pile. But all your other numbers go into your trash. So you care very deeply about what you're playing as well as what other people are feeding you. But there's also a way later on in the game to cycle cards from your trash back into your score pile. But the opportunity cost is limited. And so it's a fascinating interplay without being obtuse. Because that's one of the things. A lot of trick-taking games in the hobbyist space at that time, I'm thinking of games particularly like Mew. Mew is, I think, the standard bearer of kind of clever but really, really obtuse. And I appreciate it when games can either be obtuse in a really fascinating way, like, say, for example, Ghosts of Christmas, which definitely blew my head wide open.
Yeah.
Or is sufficiently straightforward that you don't have to worry about those things, but still gets to be clever, like Bargain Hunter is.
You know, talking of card play, there was one element that I did quite appreciate, which is, like, if you win a trick, you either get to take a point, which is nothing, because you need, like, 40 to end the game, and then, you know, winning score is 45, 50, something like that, probably. Or you can take a card that was in the trick, any of the cards, and put it into your hand for the next round, which I felt was pretty big. And I'm not sure how much people were utilizing that, but there was certainly, because it's like a multi-round game, there were rounds where I was like, well, this is a really bad hand, but if I can win some tricks with some pretty good cards in them, you know, like I can set myself up for the next round. And that actually proved pretty big to me. So it opened up that play space a little bit more than I initially gave it credit for.
It did, and I did make use of it. Like, for example, I did specifically set aside the one trump, I think, twice over the course of the game played, because it's such a good card. But given that Power Vacuum is apt to last only four-ish rounds anyway, you're not going to be using that in the last round very successfully, and I don't really know that there's a huge range for planning. But yeah, it's a nice feature to have, especially given that, as you say, the rewards for winning a trick are relatively minimal. Anyway, to circle back to what I said at the very beginning about the incredible tiebreaker condition, and I really appreciate it when games lean into this, because there was no reason. Power Vacuum could have very simply said, game ends when somebody cracks 40 points, that's it, high score wins, and then invented a tiebreaker. Instead, what they did was, every time you get 10 points, you cash it in for one quarter of a statue in a very sort of satire of Stalinist public monuments. And once your statue is finished, that triggers the end of the game. And it specifically says, you know, you can mix and match the plinth and the base and all these other things. If there's a tie at the end of the game and everyone has the same number of leftover points, whoever has the nicest statue wins the tie. And that is such a corner case of unnecessary whimsy, but I nonetheless appreciate it a great deal.
I think it was reinforced by the rulebook having a whole page on how to build statues that serve no gameplay function whatsoever. It's just like, here's some house rules you might like to have. They didn't say that, but like, it pretty much felt like it. It was like, here's some vague rules for how to build these statues, but, you know, at the end they just went, do what you like.
Yeah, and I can't help but think, connecting to the conversation about Dungeon Scrawlers, that sometimes the same people that would bounce off of Dungeon Scrawlers would look at that section in a rulebook and say, why are you wasting my time? And I respect that. That's a legitimate perspective as far as what you want out of hobby gaming. But I'm definitely at the stage in my hobby gaming experience where I look at something like that and I say, absolutely shine on, you crazy diamond. Yeah, I don't know where I'd put Power Vacuum all told. I'd probably want to play it a few more times to see how robust it is. But I have a lot of enthusiasm for the fundamental power dynamic, but I have a fair amount of skepticism about the actual card play. So if that sounds appealing as far as the breakdown of trick takers goes, then this might be for you. But as it is, I wanted a little bit more out of the card play.
I can see what you mean, but I think it's pretty good in good company, I think.
Well, fair, but anything is good in good company.
You know, there's some things that are pretty bad in good company.
Okay. Or at least almost anything can be made better in good company. How's that as a compromise?
You know, we sometimes joke. Sometimes. Me and some of my friends have a code for when we're not enjoying the board game. And what we say is, well, I enjoyed the company.
That's the board gaming equivalent of bless your heart?
Yeah, pretty much. I have played Leviathan Wilds, and whilst we're on player count, I have for the first time played Leviathan Wilds with four players. And this is where the game really opened up for me in terms of like that real strong co-op feel. Like, I started almost getting like these flashbacks to playing Pandemic and the difference in the player count between two players and four players. Ah. And how much harder this was with four players, because it takes so long until your turn comes back to you. And the Leviathan hits, you know, so many times before your turn comes back to you. And you have to find so many solutions. And like, if, because the cool thing about it is that you have these like cards in your hand that you can play at any time. But if you play all of them, then you're going to have nothing left. And in a two-player game, it's just, you know, whatever, you know, my turn's going to come back pretty soon. I'll be fine. And in a four-player game, there are so many dangers and every card is so precious. So that was really cool. And I really enjoyed that. I'm not going to get into the rules of the game because I know you've discussed it many a times already. But I did get to experience Leviathan number four, which really kind of opened up that space of poorly written rules and lacking FAQs. And like the first three Leviathans were pretty solid and fun, and they had like something different going on. And Leviathan 4 really upped the ante. I don't want to say too much about what it is because I feel like that's spoiler territory a little bit. Like, it's an experiential game, so you know, you kind of want to experience it for yourself. But more rules were added, is what I'm going to say. And those more rules did not have enough clarifiers at all, right? And a lot of this, and what the shame part of it was that, like, we kind of hyped this game up to our two friends. We're like, oh, we've been playing this. This is great. You're going to love it. Let's sit down. I spread it out on the table, you know, opened up the Leviathan. It's like, oh, we're going to be climbing this thing. And I was like, yeah, let me just see how this works. 1 second. And let me just go on BGG for a hot minute. Oh, this particular question isn't answered on BGG. So we're going to have to decide basically how this works, even though you don't know the rules of the game yet. So there was that moment, which I didn't really appreciate. But overall, the game was tremendously tense and fun. So I still had a good time.
I prefer Leviathan Wilds with four precisely because it has more of those opportunities for genuine cooperation. I wish there was more of it. Frankly, I wish there were more card effects that allow you to help people out. Now, I realize that some climbers are focused more towards support than others. I grant that. But one of my very minor critiques of Leviathan Wilds, I wish there was a little bit more baked in cooperation and player engagement in that way. Because I thoroughly enjoy it. I haven't played against Leviathan 4. I have climbed Leviathan 5, but I've seen Leviathan 4, and I could definitely imagine how there could be some ambiguity. But I'd be curious to hear your approach to this. I actually don't mind rules ambiguities as much when it's a co-op game, and it's easy to at least make a stipulation and proceed on that basis. If it prevents going forward at all, then obviously it's game breaking. But in a cooperative game, I think the threshold for certainty becomes far lower.
I think this is the one instance where the accusation of reviewer brain has some validity, because I just have to know what the intention was, right? My brain is going, no, I need to play this by the rules, because if I'm not experiencing the game as intended, then like I don't feel that comfortable commenting on it, because I don't know if I'm making the right comments or the right, you know, observations or whatever. So I get a little bit precious about that. So
I respect that.
It's hard for me.
Yeah, whereas we've internalized very clearly on this show in terms of editorial standards that you don't even really need to finish reading the rule book before you can review it. So that makes things far, far easier. On the topic of co-ops and potentially rules ambiguities, my understanding is that we have both been playing Primal the Awakening.
Yes. I have played it less than you, though, because I've only played the tutorial scenario, the prologue, whereas you have played more, right?
I have. I have now played the prologue and the first three chapters of the campaign, and this has been on the basis of the enthusiasm of the rest of the group. I didn't hate any aspect of Primal the Awakening, but I have serious questions about whether or not the overhead is worth it, especially since, as the one who owns the game and has read the rules, I'm the one primary responsible for dealing with all this stuff. One of the things that drove me up the wall is recurringly having to engage with this 90-page rulebook. I am not a fan of multiple rulebooks, but sometimes you gotta split things up. And when you're going to split things up, because even in the context of a single book, you still have to split things up in terms of sections, and I find their editorial choices baffling. So just as an example, Efka, you in the tutorial were told very specifically what monster cards to use based on what symbols were involved, and that sets up the behavior deck and the stance deck and the peril cards and this, that, and the other. But when setting it up for the campaign, I spent a full 10 minutes, very much like your Leviathan Wilds, you know, wait while I go check on BGG and so forth, to find various trailing indicators about this, that, and the other, the special rules relating to the monster we were hunting, various core rules with respect to setting up based on the difficulty level. And when I eventually found the key chart that I was looking for in the last place that I would expect, I was so frustrated, I literally had to get up and go for a short walk. So I didn't just scream at the rulebook for a full 5 seconds with everyone else at the table. And look, it's a Kickstarter. I'm used to bad rulebooks. I'm used to things organized in strange ways. And I will say that the overhead in terms of paperwork of Primal the Awakening is a lot lower than a lot of its other ilk. But my enthusiasm for the core combo gameplay is only going to get me so far when there's all this other stuff to be dealing with. And so I'm happy to go along with the group. They want to keep playing. But I probably would have abandoned it after the last session, frankly.
My very early impressions are almost the exact opposite of yours. So
wild.
I know, right? So I didn't have an issue with the rulebook so far. Granted, I only had to read 2/3 of it. 1/3 for the first part of the game, which was, you know, still 40 pages, but like it's not like an A4 format rulebook, yeah. Right? And there's a lot of diagrams and examples. And I found the flow of the way the rulebook taught the game for the complexity that it was pretty good. Like I didn't have any questions afterwards.
Yeah. The tutorial is fine.
I did have to look things up a few times, but again, it was only like, you know, there's this one section of the rulebook. Would it have been better if it was separated? Yes, probably. But at least there was an index with like a lot of, you know, information, you know, kind of condensed into separate sections. So, you know, overall, I found the rulebook okay. It was the card play that again, I've only played the tutorial, so I don't know. I didn't find anything particularly obnoxious about it or like, you know, egregious in terms of making, you know, me do things in games that I don't enjoy doing. It was fine. I just didn't find the hook yet. Do you know what I mean? And I'm wondering if that hook is something that comes later, because I know that you get to craft various items and then, you know, kind of spec your character towards various builds. So I want to see how that plays out. I haven't experienced that yet. But so far, it leaned very far into that dimension of games that are so reactive that you just don't get to kind of formulate any long-term strategy. And it felt like it should have been easier with two players because there's not like too much chaos going on. But even then, it felt like, oh, okay, I see what happened. And I see why we got punished, because step A led into step B, led into step C, led into step D, and then eventually cascaded into the current situation that I am in on my turn as it begins. But I'm not sure how much of that I could have influenced. It's very much one of those games that kind of like makes you see the mistake, you know, 3 turns after you've done it, and then makes you go, oh, you should have done this. And I'm like, oh, okay, but is that situation ever going to come up in a game again? Some of them will, right? Some of them, I imagine, are common, and it's something you learn. But is the game interesting after you do learn that? Or I don't know.
So here's my speculation. I suspect immediately after playing the tutorial, I would have had the same reaction you did to my own comments, because the tutorial has all the information you need for the tutorial. And I agree that, when it's actually addressing a given topic, it is presented with relative clarity and lots of helpful examples. But when trying to situate a given combat encounter with the broader setup requirements of the campaign, it's that friction and that juxtaposition that I found difficult to find the answers to the questions that I had. Because the tutorial is a very managed experience. Take out these cards, do this thing. There you go. That's the monster setup. In the context of the campaign, I felt adrift in terms of being able to set up the basic elements. And in terms of the card combos, after my first play, I was not impressed. I felt that it was very mechanical. The card play was relatively straightforward. I didn't really feel like I was getting any leverage out of the way the monster AI works, et cetera, et cetera. But that is one area where I am appreciating Primal the Awakening more. Even after the second play, and it helps because also we were playing with four players, and so there was more opportunity for, again, like those moments in Leviathan Wilds where you're playing off each other and helping people and boosting each other and setting up blocking patterns, et cetera, et cetera. All those player interactive bits where the asymmetric skills get to interface in interesting ways. And even in like the second turn of the second play, everyone was having these aha moments. Oh, this is how this card works. Okay, fine. And it wasn't a rules question. This was just us learning how to make the system work to our advantage in a satisfying gameplay way, rather than just like, oh, okay, now this opaque rule makes sense to me way. Because once we actually start fighting monsters, once all that's besides, I have recurring gripes about how there's dazed and stun and blind and fatigue and exertion and all these other things. It's like, ugh, none of these make any sense intuitively. You have to look them up every time. At least I know where to look them up, though. And better reference works would absolutely help. But we, all of us at the table, I think, are feeling like, even independently of the fact that we get to spec out our builds based on gear and other things, that we are learning how to make the cards work more to our advantage and to be better teammates. And that part is the only reason why I've been willing to put up with everything else.
There is one rule in the game that, like, doesn't make any sense to me. And I want to ask someone who's played more than the tutorial mission, that being you, if you still feel like it doesn't make any sense, or whether you disagree. It says that every time you begin a new campaign, you must play the tutorial mission. As if, like, it repeats that rule. Yeah. So many times. And I'm like, that's clearly nonsense, because nothing happens in that tutorial mission that affects the campaign in any way whatsoever. But you must do it, apparently. Why? Why does that exist?
This is going to sound very harsh. I don't mean it to be harsh, and I don't mean this to be ad hominem. I suspect it might have something to do, not everything, but something to do with the fact that they seem very pleased with this world that they've built and this story that they want to tell. And they tell you to take notes and make speculations about what various mysteries are. This probably makes me a bad game explainer. When given the option of reading aloud a massive chunk of text before going and killing this funny-looking dinosaur, or just summarizing it to my players saying, blah, 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 there's some nerds we need to go rescue, I have said, we just have some nerds to go rescue. Let's go kill this funny-looking dinosaur. And so that's what we've been doing. But I have been speed reading them and just being like, nothing in this seems interesting, so I'm just not going to bother reading it aloud because life is short and I have to do so much reading aloud anyway for all the other campaign games that I'm playing that I actually like the stories of, so forget about it. And that might be why they tell you to go play the tutorial.
The tutorial text was long and not interesting. And I'd say that with a heavy heart, because I want every narrative... every campaign game that has narrative sections, I want it to be interesting. I want it to be like Artisans of Splendid Vale or Oathsworn, you know? The two current, from a narrative standpoint, gold standards, you know?
Agreed.
I think. But they just aren't, you know?
Yeah.
Like, or even like Descent Third Edition, you know, it had a few missteps, but I think broadly the characters were interesting, you know, the mystery was interesting, something was happening. It felt like this was a story worth reading. Nothing so far in Primal the Awakening hints at a story that is anything but verbose, I guess is the right word. Yeah.
That is a good word for it, yes.
Mark, I've been playing Dune Imperium, the digital version.
Okay.
And from the many episodes of Swag that I've listened to, I know that you are not a fan of Dune Imperium. And correct me if I'm wrong, but chiefly your criticism is that it's not a particularly interesting deck builder, or not a particularly interesting worker placement game, or not a particularly interesting area control game all combined into one. Did I get the right impression?
Yes, that is a fair characterization of much of my criticism, yes.
Okay, so this is all I'm going to say, right? So when I order an egg, if like a waiter comes up to me and I'm having breakfast, right?
All right.
When I say, can I have an egg? My general expectation is that what's going to come is probably going to be a hard-boiled egg, maybe a fried one, you know?
Okay.
Maybe even a poached one, but like generally I'm getting an egg, right? If they brought me a croissant, right? I would be like, what's this? This is an egg. But the waiter would say, ah, yes. You see, but it has an egg in it. And so this analogy brings us to Dune : Imperium, where I feel like it's the croissant, right? It has the constituent parts, like it has egg, it has butter, it has milk, right? But you're not getting any of these parts. You're getting a croissant, a holy union of all of these ingredients. So I feel like Dune Imperium is one of those games that you can't really judge by its constituent parts because it's been cooked. You know, it's been fermented. You know, the yeast has risen and bloomed, and then you know, you glazed it and you laminated the dough and all that kind of stuff. And
right
after hours and hours of work, you get Dune Imperium. That's all I wanted to say, really.
My counter would be twofold. Number one, I would just merely observe, this is being uncharitable, but it's nonetheless an observation that I have, is that you are verging perilously close to the common saw, oh, you didn't like it because you wanted it to be something else. Number two, to continue your metaphor, I would say that if Dune Imperium is a croissant, my experience of it is that it is a croissant poorly prepared using poor quality ingredients. And so the constituent parts do actually matter based in terms of their inherent quality to begin with and how skillfully they are manipulated.
Well, I enjoyed this tete-a-tete. It was good. I just needed to get my word in.
Absolutely, I respect that. And I am vaguely curious to eventually try the pseudo sequel, because I do think that with some rounds of polish, I don't think that the formula is fundamentally busted. And I didn't have any fundamental objections to it as an ill-conceived project. I just didn't really like how it shook out in a number of ways. And I'm always willing to watch a system iterate. And I'm a big fan of just observing the development work that goes into second editions, if there's any substantial changes, or backporting some of the innovations from expansions. So I do plan on trying the revised version sooner or later, and that may help change my mind.
I really like the revised version. My immediate instinct of it was that, like, this is just so much. This is, everything has been reconsidered. You know,
right.
It feels like the changes are small, but they're quite significant. So I like it a lot. But that's why I've been playing the original. Because it's digital on an app, so it's easily accessible. You can just play it solo, you know, and that's kind of good because you get to experience a lot of the cards and learn about a lot of the cards. And I kind of want to go back to like the original and feel the changes out, you know, really kind of get to grips with them. So I've been really enjoying that process.
Well, I'm not a huge fan of digital implementation of board games, which actually is a good segue to our feature game, but I will merely point out that that is to be discussed later, and we are now going to take a brief break to pay some bills.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Driving plays a big part in driving the local economy. It helps us all get where we're going and creates good jobs close to home. At Synovus Energy, our refineries in Toledo and Lima are a reliable domestic source of gasoline, diesel, and jet fuel. Plus, more than 2,300 employees and contractors work for us here in Ohio. See how we're helping local communities move forward at synovus.com.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
And we're back. Now on to the news and why it doesn't matter. So first off, first and foremost, I would like to give a brief update as to the health status of one Michael Walker. He is, as ever, an absolute tribute to strength of character, and insofar as he has been demonstrating his ability to bounce back, he is engaging in the difficult work, and I have been seeing him on the reg, and he has shown remarkable progress. I have no doubt that he will eventually get his wish and get back to you, listeners, before too long. I heard him openly musing about, well, you know, we could probably bring a microphone in here, and we can. I'm like, dude, just no, just we got it. Get better. It'll be all right. Next up, we've talked about Leviathan Wilds. Leviathan Wilds is going to be doing the standard crowdfunding thing. That is to say, it was fulfilled recently, so it's going to be up on crowdfunding again with an expansion and a reprint. So such is the way of things. The cycle is complete. And
an FAQ, right?
See, that's the thing. There's some discussion, actually, that they might not actually be fixing legit misprints in the base game. So this is an ongoing story. That was the next thing I was going to flag. I don't know what Mooncrab has in mind, but this may be a strange example of them going to reprint and not even bothering to change any of the original proofs just because they don't want to. If that's true, I'm unimpressed. More to follow on that.
That hurt me inside. It did.
As well it should. Finally, the great intersection of sci-fi board game and dexterity that was started way back when with Ascending Empires continues to yield fruit. So Flick Fleet is brilliant, Ascending Empires is brilliant, and Matt Leacock and Josh Capel are going to be publishing a game called Flickering Stars, because if you're going to be moving big spaceships across space, you might as well be able to do so by flicking them, which is absolutely a marriage of dexterity and strategy that I adore seeing. And Matt Leacock, of course, is the designer of Pandemic, as well as Daybreak and a number of other fabulous Forbidden games. And so I am very much looking forward to trying Flickering Stars, because I'm always willing to flick pew-pew spaceships across a table.
You know, I feel like scientists are missing a trick. I read so many sci-fi novels and watch videos about astrophysics, and everyone's talking about antimatter drives or, you know, warping through wormholes or whatever.
Yeah.
Like, why not flicking? Has anyone considered flicking?
It's a good point. I've seen Michael Walker flick discs, and I would wager that they have exited the table at faster than the speed of light. So I definitely think that this is an underexplored area of propulsion. So that is the news and why it doesn't matter. We now move on to our feature game, which is Slay the Spire, the board game. Slay the Spire, the board game, was designed by Gary Dworetsky off of a video game done by Anthony Giovanotti and Casey Yano. And it was published by Contention Games in 2024. This is only the second product offered by Contention Games. Their previous offering was Imperium the Contention, which was an asymmetric card-driven 4Xy adjacent kind of stripped-down thing. Afka, why don't you give us an unhelpful summary about what one does in Slay the Spire, the board game?
So in Slay the Spire, the board game, you play a team of parasite exterminators. You have a van, you drive up to this really tall apartment block, and then every floor is just infested. So you have to go in with the team, and, you know, on some floors you might find some infestations and you need to clear them. On some you don't. But you keep climbing, you know, you keep climbing. But here's the catch. You see, you are not the first exterminators who've been called in. And some of them, you know, got up maybe as far as the second or third floor. Some maybe as far as the 10th. But they all eventually just find the job too much and give up. And because they've already climbed so far, they don't want to carry their gear back, so they just leave it there. So every time you exterminate a room, you might find some of their gear and just equip yourself with the exterminating gear. And hopefully that you know, that will be enough to kind of propel you forward and eventually get to the very top of the building where you will find the ultimate parasite boss that you also need to exterminate. And if you win, you get paid.
On the topic of fulfilling remits, I have to thank you, Efka. That was probably the least helpful summary I've heard in quite some time. Well done.
Thank you.
So what experience have you had with the original Slay the Spire, namely the PC / Android / Switch game?
I got to, and this is weirdly embarrassing, but very, very much like me, I got to Ascension 19.
Oh, wow.
And then just stopped. I don't know why I stopped. I was like, just 19's good enough.
Well, that's often the way with roguelites, right? They can completely... Yeah. I've had experience with roguelites. I played a lot of them where it completely consumes my life. And then I get to some threshold. Maybe that threshold is the actual real ending. Maybe it's just side of the actual real ending. And I go from playing it like an hour a day for weeks to just never touching it again. And so I confess that story doesn't shock me. But I didn't know that I was in the presence of an A19. Not quite an A20, of course.
No, no. I didn't get that far.
I have some experience with the computer version, well, rather a lot of it, but I never really got very good at it. I certainly didn't get that high in the Ascension rankings. And this is why I frequently said of Slay the Spire, the board game, that it is the answer to the question that no one asked, because the PC game is a card game. It is not hiding that it's a card game. It's not pretending it's anything else. It is literally a deck builder in form, execution, presentation, and mechanics. And so my first question when realizing what they were, that they were doing an adaptation was, why? Did you have that reaction?
Yeah, exact same reaction. My kind of instinct for this was that there's so very little time that board games get to influence video games. It is normally the other way around, right? We have an N number of video game / the board game. There's so many of them. And they are very frequently just cash-ins, right? Which yes. I don't think is a contentious thing to say. Because contention games get it. But it's sort of become the default, you know, and you, with that default being present in the industry, like whenever you see something like that, you kind of go in with that expectation already. But when you take something that is a board game mechanism, not maybe directly a specific game, but a mechanism influencing a much bigger industry, it's like, okay, something came from us. That's nice. You know, like we gave fruit to something, like, you know, like D&D all those years ago, you know, added the experience system into public consciousness and, you know, video games adopted it and now it's everywhere, right? Like, deck building is a much smaller thing, but there's so many indie and non-indie games that use this mechanism that, I don't know, it's just really cool to see. And Slay the Spire, I don't know if it was the first, but it's definitely the first hit of its kind, you know? So yeah. it meant something to me, you know? And the fact that it was going back to being a board game, like, that felt, there was something wrong there. Like, I don't want to say that, like, you know, it, like, I don't know. Like, I don't want to sound cynical about it, I guess is what I mean. I wasn't, because my second instinct is always, well, I'm a reviewer, so I have to try this thing anyway, right? Because I might be wrong.
Right.
And as so you very often are, right? I'm glad I did, I have to say, because it surprised me. It surprised me quite a bit. And I'm glad that it did. I'm glad it proved my initial instincts wrong.
So why don't you spend a little bit more time talking about the ways in which it surprised you?
So, I just literally, as we were speaking, posted a video review about it. And my two points that I make in the video, and these are the only two points, is that, first of all, so I have this thing where I think for a video game to board game adaptation to be successful, it needs essentially four ingredients. One is obviously, and this is kind of like a given, right, is you need like an understanding of the source material that you are adapting. But like that's kind of a basic sentence, but a lot hides behind the sentence, because there is understanding and then there's like kind of like vibing, right? Mm-hmm. Like You know, there is something sometimes about a piece of work that really connects with you, and you see the intentions, and you kind of find that. I find that feeling very wholesome when that happens. Okay, like this really connected to me. Let's say I was a really big fan of Disco Elysium, and I played a lot of Disco Elysium. But if I didn't have that connection, how would I translate that into a board game?
Mm-hmm.
Right? How does that appear? How does that happen? Is it even possible? You know, can I relay this connection? So I think a lot of video game to board game adaptations fall at this first hurdle because, like, okay, they have an understanding of the game, but they didn't consider how is this even going to be adapted, and is it even possible to adapt it? And maybe I should just stop right there, which is the second point. Have an intimate understanding of board games.
Right.
The third point also connects to this, which is be willing to change things. Right? And number four is have the skill to implement all of the above into something cohesive. Right? So I don't know. Like, it's hard. It's a hard thing to do. And I think that's why so many of these adaptations are bad. What should have tipped me off is that as long as these four criteria are met, when you have something that is essentially already a digital board game, you have so much of your work cut out for you. So if you do meet these four criteria, then you might end up with something that's pretty good, right? And that to me personally is what's happening here. So thing number one I like is the math. I like how they changed the math. Everything in this adaptation is smaller, the numbers are smaller, but like the implications are different. So one of the examples that really struck to me, I was playing The Defect in my first playthrough, and I noticed that, okay, so, you know, a basic attack card in the video game is 6, in the board game it's 1, right? But my orbs at the end of turn in the video game, they deal 3 damage, in the board game they deal 1 damage, right? That's a different ratio of reduction. And that to me became immediately interesting because I was like, okay, so there's all these familiar elements. There's all these cards that I recognize. There's all these like things that I have almost like an innate sense because I played the game quite a bit, right? On how I manipulate them and how I interact with them. And I'm realizing that they don't work exactly in the same way. And they don't create exactly the same interactions and exactly the same combos. And some cards are a little bit different. So it was almost like when you're traveling and you've just, you know, been to Germany last year and now you're going to Austria and you go, well, you know, they're pretty close together. I imagine there's some broad similarities, but you go to Austria and you're like, whoa, wait, there's a lot of subtle differences here, right? So That was the interesting part of Slay the Spire, the board game, to me. The first half. The second half is just the fact that it's co-op, because that completely flips the whole design on its head. Because to take these four characters that you're very familiar with and then allow you to play with them together, that's a special feeling. That's really something else.
It's simultaneously so familiar, and I feel like a vast proportion of the design work was already done because the digital version is a board game, is a card game. But at the same time, there was a tremendous amount of rebalancing that needed to be done. And consequently, in that transition, a lot feels different. And I, like you, first time I played The Defect. And indeed, realizing how the orbs work differently is a great sort of microcosm about how a lot of these changes affect. Because on top of that, I will point something else out. And this is one of my curiosities when I first saw that it was going to become a physical board game. Was your orbs in the video game hit a random target. And similarly, monsters proc a semi-random set of behavioral traits. And various artifacts proc after N instances of Y happening. And all of these things are things that are trivial to track in a digital version and would become so cumbersome to track in a physical version. And in many cases, I think the devs for the board game made the right calls. So, in the case of orbs, they don't hit a random target anymore, you choose the target. Okay, but suddenly you're making orbs yet more powerful. Whether that balancing work is done with an appropriate level of overall balance, I think is a separate question. But in terms of ease of use, it was absolutely the right call. in terms of monster behavior, they just cycle through or engage in a set pattern based on a die roll, which in turn modifies how artifacts work. At the top of every round in Slay the Spire, the board game, you just roll a die, and that influences a whole bunch of different things that might trigger off of that.
I love this mechanism so much.
It works so well to capture a lot of, as you were saying, the same vibes, the same rhythm of how artifacts proc, of how monsters behave, of how other random things trigger, of how various cards operate, but they just tie it to this global modifier that you set at the top of the round, and it's genius. And it is so user-friendly, and it opens up other possibilities. Like, for example, last playthrough I did, I had an artifact that allowed me once per room to modify that die result, which was great.
But also, there is, like, this ritualistic moment to it that feels so good, you know? And it just wasn't present in the video game, because everything was automated, right? Like, this is one of the few cases where an adaptation, you know, kind of like builds on its strengths rather than, you know, kind of acquiesces to its weaknesses. Mm-hmm. You know, it introduces something that is very board gamey and very communal. You know, like we roll a die once at the beginning of the round and it affects everything. So much depends, you know, on that red wheelbarrow. And there's an artifact called Happy Flower. In the video game, every phase hands, it gives you one energy. And tell me, Mark, how many times have you forgotten that that exists?
All the time, yeah.
Right? And like, you just don't in the board game. Not because, like, the die is a reminder or whatever, but because, like, the die affects so much and the flower is tied to it. So, like, you roll the die and you go, aha, and this effect, and this effect, and this effect. And that's that, like, cool board gamey moment that, like, I kind of enjoy playing games for, where, and especially co-op games, where, like, you kind of get to go to your board and kind of assess what just happened, and then everyone lets everyone know, like, hey, I can do this, and, oh, and hey, I can do that, right? And you start sharing and discussing. I don't know, it's just, I really like that die mechanism.
There's a balance to be struck in both digital games and board games. That is a subtly, the variables are different, but the fundamental balance is the same, and that is the balance between opacity and information overload. Because you can't make fundamental things as opaque in a board game that you can make in a digital game. Like, I can have 15 artifacts in a run of Slay the Spire, the digital game, that proc off of various things at various rhythms, and I may forget about those details, but I can still feel like I'm playing the game even when I get these random surprises and feel like I'm not doing things optimally. You can't pull that kind of crap in a board game because it's literally impossible for something to proc if you've forgotten that it's there. But at the same time, you want to capture some of that magic of having a whole bunch of cool stuff that triggers and feeling like this run is different and you get to have powerful effects. And I think they nailed the balance in the board game just about perfectly. They really did a stellar job of getting that. And the Happy Flower is a good example of that, I think.
Yeah. And just, you know, sometimes there you just have things that are completely different. And you can kind of see, like, this is just, you know, like, they just didn't know how to make it work. And they decided to do something different, right? Which is kind of fine, because everything is already so familiar. You know, I feel like a lot of times adaptations, or, like, any kind of board game adaptations lean into, I'm going to use a dirty word, but they lean into memetics, right? You know, like, you have the Alien board game. Well, it must have all the Alien characters, like Lieutenant Ripley and Ash and that cat from Aliens. But wait a minute, those two were never in the same film. Do you know what I mean? Like,
yes.
Like, so you have this, like, smorgasbord of things that people are familiar with, so that they can kind of, like, culturally relate to this piece of work, right? Whereas I like it when there is a change. I like it when, like, I'm not just, you know, rehashing the same kind of almost, like, still pictures of familiar things into like, a manipulable board. I want it to somehow speak on its own and be on its own. I don't think Slay the Spire, the board game, does that too much, but it does it a little bit, you know? And yes. I feel like in ways that matters, because then you have like these subtle changes to cards that you kind of didn't consider before because maybe they weren't very good or very interesting. And suddenly this does something different and you're like, oh, okay, I get to re-explore this thing that I'm familiar with but always dismissed. And now I get to engage in it in a different way.
Part of me wishes they actually riffed a little bit more because there's a lot of solid innovation in terms of how some of the cards work. For one of my favorite examples is Leap, which in the digital version, it just gives you block, whatever. In the board game version, it allows you to change places with one of your allies, and suddenly the monsters that were damaging me might be damaging you instead. And that might, there might be great reasons to think that that makes good sense or bad sense or what have you. And the number of cards that interface with the genuine novel elements of the space opened up by co-op, the spatiality of which monster is fighting which, I kind of wish they happened a little bit more often. Again, it's a balancing act. How faithful do you want to be? How much do you want to risk alienating existing users and or upsetting the existing ecosystem and balance? But those moments when they happen, when it's like, oh, this is really different from how it works in the video game, I think is simultaneously a testament to how faithful they've been with everything else, but an indication of how they could have experimented more. Like an example of that is the Claw Pack. If you have the Kickstarter version,
yes,
they didn't know how to implement Claw, so they gave you like three or four different ways to do Claw. And part of it's weird just seeing them riff on that idea, and I kind of wish I'd seen more of it.
Yeah, right. And I guess that's because this is Kickstarter or crowdfunding release. We will see more of that because it's not like there is any more Slay the Spire, right? And they will have to have new stuff because that's how crowdfunding works. You got to have new stuff, right? So
we'll see,
right? But the other thing that you reminded me of with Leap was just the basic defense card. Like, because if you upgrade it, it's like 2 defense to any player. And yes, that's such a subtle, but such a good change. It took me an entire game to notice it. Because here I am playing Slay the Spire, the board game, having a pretty good time, right? And then towards the end of the session, Elaine's like, and I can give you 2 defense. And I'm like, how are you going to do that? Well, with the basic defense card. And I'm like, but that just gives defense to you. And she's like, no. You know, have a look.
Right.
And I've realized that I've been neglecting to upgrade it because I was like, I don't need to upgrade basic defense cards. Right. But Elaine never played the digital Slay the Spire.
Exactly.
So she was just experimenting with things and seeing what they do. And like, I might have not noticed that ever because, because I probably would have never upgraded a basic defense card.
Well, you and I, and everybody else that's played a fair amount of the PC version, we have these huge blind spots. Like when playing with people who don't have that level of experience, there are all these questions come up that strike us as transparently obvious. Like one of them is, okay, so how do I transfer defense to another player? And the answer is, well, broadly, unless the card says you do, you don't. And they're like, oh, well, that seems strange. I'm like, does it? Oh, well, I'm used to it. Moving on. And by the same token, explaining how to play Slay the Spire, the board game, to somebody who's played the PC version takes about, I don't know, 30 seconds, if that. Here are the changes. Okay, everything else works the way you might think. Let's go.
You know, it wasn't that hard explaining it to Elaine as well, who's just generally familiar with a lot of deck builders, right? She's just never played Slay the Spire. And we actually, like the first time we played it, we just got our new puppy. And we were so tired. We were so tired. And like Elaine was in this sort of state where like she was too tired to do anything, but also at the same time, too kind of frustrated by the monotony of having to look after this puppy that she just wanted desperately to do something else. And so the puppy fell asleep because it's late in the evening, but like she doesn't really want to play a board game because it's late in the evening as well, you know? And I'm like, listen, like, let's just, like, it'll take me 30 seconds to explain this to you because you play deck builders, right? Like, just let's sit down and maybe it'll, you know, unwind you. And the magic of it was that I could explain it to Elaine in about 30 seconds where, like, I gave her a starting deck. Like, this does one attack. This does one defense. This does a special icon that means vulnerable, right? Because she was playing the Ironclad. And that was enough for us to play about, like, 2 combat encounters and, like, an event. you know, and I didn't really need to teach anything more than that as we were going along.
That does raise a question, though. I have an open question. I haven't decided how I feel too much about the pacing of Slay the Spire, because I find my impression thus far, having played a number of different campaigns, is that they say basically the expectation is in the rulebook that a single session is a single act. It's a three-act structure, not narratively, but just in terms of going through the different floors, as it were. And I personally think that I find one act to be a little bit too long to get through a three-act in one sitting, and a little bit too short to feel like a satisfying single sitting. I don't know what your impression is.
Yeah, broadly similar. Like, a lot of our Slay the Spire was played in bursts because it was so easy to step away from, and we have one of those tables that, you know, the fancy board game tables.
Yep.
That we can just cover it up and go away and do something else, you know? So we didn't really follow that structure because it didn't feel intuitive to us. But what did feel intuitive was that this is broadly a game you can step away from anytime. The only criteria is that if you do want to break in the middle of an act, you have to, like, I don't know, either preserve the actual spire board, you know, with the tokens of what you encounter, or like take a picture or whatever, you know. But that way felt pretty good because you could pretty much set your own pace given by like circumstance. So sometimes we would literally sit down for like 15 minutes and play a little bit of Slay the Spire, and sometimes we'd sit down for like 2 hours and play a lot of Slay the Spire, and for that it felt fantastic. But I think intuitively I feel that you're right, that like one act isn't quite enough, but the whole thing is way too much.
In terms of a literally a domestic context of leaving it set up, that was my first exposure to Slay the Spire. I was staying with some friends who had a copy before I got mine, because for whatever reason, Fulfillment hates me, independent of the fact that I'm Canadian. And yeah, we've got some time. Let's go through some encounters. And that may be a couple of encounters. It may be two acts, whatever. And that was ideal. But in terms of other kinds of gaming events, whether it's a game night, whether it's a public gaming event, what have you, I feel like it might be in a bit of an awkward position where if you survive the first two acts, going the full distance might be longer than anyone wants to commit to, and it might start feeling a little repetitive. The pacing is good overall. Like, I was also initially concerned about whether, for people accustomed to the instant gratification of the PC version where everything happens at a brisk pace, that it might feel a little too sluggish. But that has not manifested at all. It's just you basically have these hour-long chunks that you need to commit to, and that kind of pacing and that kind of setup leads me to believe that it's a little bit awkward for a lot of contexts where you can't just leave it set up.
One thing you mentioned, you know, that like as people who are like, we've played some Slay the Spire, we're familiar with it, you know, and so we have like these preconceptions. One thing that really struck me playing with someone who hasn't was like when we actually finished the game, like, you know, beat campaign free. So it's not anyway, let's not get into spoiler territory, although I suppose it's not really a spoiler that, you know, in roguelite games you have just, you know, always a little bit more if you want it. But yeah, you know, we finished Act 3 and Elaine said, so do we really have to start from Act 1 again? And I was like, well, yeah, you know, that's how you play this game, right? Like, you got it because you build your deck gradually. You have to. And then I was like, wait a minute, but though, like, isn't this a great point? Because I'm so used to it, you know, I'm so used to the roteness of that kind of going through the motions. And in a video game, it's so fast. It's kind of weird in a board game if you think about it. And I didn't mind it at first until someone who's not familiar with the source material mentioned it to me, and I was like, oh no, actually, yeah, that's kind of not great, because the game relies on your familiarity with the source material. I think it's expressly made for people who have played the video game, and I'm not sure how much room there is for people who haven't, you know, or have like a great degree of willingness to put up with the weirdness of it.
That fundamental tempo of getting attached to your build, of reveling in all these effects that you have, of getting all those relics and what have you, in any roguelike game, and then being super jazzed about it, and then the run ends either successfully or unsuccessfully, and then starting back at zero, is a very, very particular vibe that, again, if you've played lots of roguelites, you're used to. Sometimes it's not ideal, but it's something that you're accustomed to, but it is incredibly artificial. And I can completely respect the fact that somebody would really keenly feel the desire not to go back to just playing on a turn two strikes and a block, because it's not as fun as what you've just been doing before. And you certainly wouldn't want to set up a game right away after finishing Act 3, because just it would be almost like whiplash.
Yeah, right? And I mean, that gets to me in a video game sometimes. It was like, you know, you kind of, the run ends badly and you're like, oh, I can't believe I'm going back to this. But like, because you're so used to it, you know, you just kind of commit to it. And because, you know, the payoff is going to come at the end, right?
Right.
But, and I feel like some roguelite games deal with this better than others, because they're more exciting at the beginning anyway. Slay the Spire is not exciting at the beginning. Slay the Spire is very rote and very dull at the beginning. But that's because it's, weirdly, it's because it's emulating board games, right? Because, like, every time you play Dominion, you have to start at the beginning, right?
One virtue, though, that Slay the Spire has that Dominion doesn't is that I feel like, this doesn't always happen, but sometimes it's just getting the one right card, and suddenly you're immediately back into it. Suddenly, you already feel like you're now doing something that's close to what you were doing in Act 3, rather than just churning through to buy your next silver.
We're talking about Envenom, aren't we?
I wasn't specifically thinking of Envenom, but Envenom is an example. Like, there's tons of different ways that can be triggered. And I will say that one jarring aspect that I think where the subtly different joys of the PC version is when you're playing a PC roguelite, you can really feel like you're breaking something because the modifiers start stacking to a ludicrous extent and suddenly you're engaged in absurd manipulation of the system. And I never really feel like I'm quite at that level in the context of the board game. So say for sake of argument, I like the Silent. The Silent is my favorite character. And if you're playing the Silent in the PC game, you could throw like 27 shivs in one turn. And indeed, to beat some of the level 3 bosses, you have to get to the cycling where that's happening. And your shivs are doing 11 damage. And it's just ridiculous. In the context of the board game, there are just certain cognitive and physical limitations that mean that you're not going to be busting the system wide open to the same degree.
I like that. I really like that. I feel like, okay, but we already have that in the video game. So the way I'm treating Slay the Spire, the board game, is basically like a sequel. This is, to me, like what it would be like if you could play the same game but in co-op, right? And like this sort of, when I look at it like that, I'm like, okay, but what I want then from a sequel is something that's more considered, right? Something that maybe is deliberately pared down and stripped down.
I see.
And kind of like, because then it opens up the space, like I said before, for all these other cards that you didn't consider before to shine. Because if you pare everything down and everything's a bit more level, yes, you don't have these busted combos. But like at the same time, it opens up this play space for other parts to come in, right? Because what the problem with busted combos is that, like, unless you get the busted combo, the game stops being interesting because you're playing with cards that broadly, like, don't congeal into anything. And now there's a lot more space for things to congeal. Like, you know, I opened up 3 cards and none of them are particularly great, but they will do something. Whereas in the video game, you open up 3 cards and they're not particularly great and you go, skip, right? So I think there's something there.
You haven't skipped card rewards in the board game?
I have, but only towards, you know, like the very end when it's, you know, broadly a bad idea to put anything into your deck.
Sure. I am not blind to the advantages that you get from foreclosing busted combos, but I'm also not completely blind to the joys of playing a single card and having 17 effects proc.
Yeah.
I, you know, is it basically like a slot machine? Maybe sometimes. And maybe it's just a dopamine hit, but I do appreciate that. And I will say that one of the virtues of your better done roguelites in the digital space is the reliability with which you can build into those busted combos. And I think that's a legitimate design avenue, but it is a salient difference with the board game, because you just can't do that in a board game context. Not really. Have you ever played Xenoshift?
No, I have not.
People hate Xenoshift. I love it. And I just wanted to say that sometimes I wish that Slay the Spire was a little bit more like Xenoshift, because one of the virtues of Xenoshift is that it really does lean into the co-op a lot more than many co-op deck builders. Almost all of your effects can be used for anybody at the table. Whenever you buy a card, it can go to anybody at the table. And so the opportunity to collaboratively deal with the threats that you're dealing with is much, much higher in the context of a game like Xenoshift than it is in Slay the Spire. I don't object to the fact that very often, you know, you can play through a turn and barely touch base with your colleagues in a game of Slay the Spire, the board game. That's fine. It works out okay. And the moments of cooperation are there and very, very tangible. But very often it's the case that someone looks around and says, can anybody do X for me? And they say, I literally have no ability to produce that effect for anyone but myself. And I appreciate the fact that some designs do a slightly better job of that.
Yeah, I think for me, maybe it is a little bit of the novelty of the ability to just do that. Just like, you know, have the Ironclad give a strength token to the Silent. That is something that you just couldn't do before. So
absolutely.
I am very much approaching this as an enthusiast who didn't want this, but then, mm-hmm. you know, tried it anyway and kind of just, I don't know, was very surprised by it, because it really opened up things that I just never thought that it would. And so from that perspective, I think I'm kind of, you know, almost ignorant to its faults, because I'm trying to find them, but I'm just so enamored with it that I get to experience this game that I really like in completely different ways, and in ways that still work and, you know, make it just as interesting, or sometimes more interesting. I'm not even bothered by things like that. I'm like, yes, it could be a little bit more co-op. Yeah, I that sounds right. Yeah, don't care.
I do say that even though I don't think it's absolutely one of my, you know, favorite co-ops of the past few years, I do think that this is a masterclass in how to adapt a property so as to exploit some of the original strengths while introducing some of the strengths of the new medium. I agree with you entirely in terms of adaptation. I think that Slay the Spire, the board game, is an unexpected triumph.
I don't have anything to add to that. I agree completely.
Well, then that's going to do it for this week for So Very Wrong About Games. Efka, again, thank you so, so much for coming to help us out. I really appreciate it. It's been a joy to have you, and you have definitely, like you do to everything else, elevated us to a considerable degree. Thank you.
Oh, shush, Mark. I was really looking forward to this. I was very, very excited to be a co-host, and I just wish it was under better circumstances. But this has been an honor. Thank you for letting me on the show and letting me be my zany self on your airtime.
It's been a sincere pleasure. Do you have anything you'd like to plug? I understand you have a channel on Vivo, I think.
Yeah, no, we make reviews of board games. What you've been listening to right now, but in video form. It's called No Pun Included. It's me and Elaine. She is sometimes my co-host, and a lot of times all of the behind-the-scenes stuff, including B-roll and playing the games and writing reviews together, or helping me edit reviews and stuff like that. So yeah, you can check that out. And we also have a podcast. It's called Talk Cardboard. And it's on all the podcast places.
Great. Please do check out Efka. He does produce stellar, stellar work. And please do not let his poor taste in Canadian friends dissuade you from consuming all of his content. So that's going to do it for this week. Thank you so, so much for joining us, all of you out there. Hope to see you again soon. Please take care of yourselves. Take care of your hobby time. And don't forget to thank your rules explainer. Bye, everybody.
Do I say bye? Do I also say bye?
You can if you want to. It's up to you.
Now I think I'm okay.
You've been listening to So Very Wrong About Games, a board gaming podcast about board games produced by Michael Walker and edited by Mark Bickman. You can find all our information at sowronggames.com. Special thanks to What Does It Eat for allowing us to use their most excellent song, FOS, as our intro. You can find them at whatdoesiteat.com. We hope to see you again soon, and as always, try to be right, but remember, you're so very wrong.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Driving plays a big part in driving the local economy. It helps us all get where we're going and creates good jobs close to home. At Synovus Energy, our refineries in Toledo and Lima are a reliable domestic source of gasoline, diesel, and jet fuel. Plus, more than 2,300 employees and contractors work for us here in Ohio. See how we're helping local communities move forward at synovus.com.